This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Yesterday, we talked about the problem of hunger as we think collectively about the power of food to connect family and friends at Thanksgiving. Rob Meehan, director of the Chittenden Emergency Food Shelf, mentioned that many of the thousands of Vermonters who come to the food shelf look like everyone else.
A lot of the folks we're serving are working, sometimes more than one job, oftentimes, and still having a hard time meeting the needs of housing and transportation.
That's not a new scenario. Here's Senator Bernie Sanders addressing a town meeting in Springfield 10 years ago.
People are working 40 and 50 hours a week, trying to pay their bills, trying to keep their heads above water economically. All of that is happening in the real world. And yet when you go to Washington, D.C., and you listen to what Congress talks about, this is an issue that to a very significant degree is ignored, is pushed under the rug, and what we're going to do tonight is bring it out in the open.
Out into the open, sure, but not solved. That assessment is echoed yet again in a new report that was just presented to Governor Peter Shumlin last week. So if having a full-time job doesn't prevent you from living below the poverty line, what can actually be done to help people make ends meet and eventually get out of poverty? A tall goal, but one that Pathways from Poverty has been charged with coming up with. That's the council that just presented its mandated report to the governor, and today we're going to talk about what's in it. Christopher Curtis is an attorney for Vermont Legal Aid and co-chair of the council, and he joins me now. Chris, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Jane.
We've been saying the same thing for a decade, more than a decade, really. People are working and they still can't make ends meet, and we can't seem to solve the problem. More than 12% of Vermonters fall below the poverty line. Certainly more Vermonters than that are struggling or are getting some sort of assistance to help make sure they can get their basic needs met. So why? What are we doing wrong? Or more pointedly, from the perspective of some people, what are they, those poor people, doing wrong?
Well, low-income Vermonters aren't doing anything wrong. They are working harder than ever to try to keep up. And I think they're suffering, frankly, from the residual effects of the Great Recession. So as you pointed out at the lead into the show, we have child poverty rates of 15%, actually almost 16% in the state of Vermont. We have extremely tight housing markets, about a 1% vacancy rate across the state, which is driving up rents and making it extremely difficult for Vermonters to have a modest amount of income, but also be able to meet their housing needs. And so all of that together just makes it very difficult for Vermonters to keep up.
So is your council actually solved with fixing the problem or charged with fixing the problem?
No, this is a council that is charged with, over a three-year period, making reports and recommendations to Governor Shumlin. And I give the governor a lot of credit for instituting this council. Governors in Vermont have been talking about poverty going back to the days of George Aiken, who frankly devoted a large share of his inaugural address to poverty. So it's a conversation the state has been engaged in for a very long time. I think the standard is, are we making progress, or how can we make progress? And as we have challenges due to economic fluctuations and cycles of increased rates of poverty, the question is, how can we be smart and make the right kinds of investments to help lift people out of poverty, get them back to work, and be able to meet their basic needs?
So to be clear-eyed about this report, if all of the recommendations that you suggest were made, you're not saying that would end poverty in Vermont?
Well, look, let's be realistic. There are a lot of recommendations in this report, and I urge your listeners to go online to the Governor Council information page, read the report.
Which we also have a link to at vpr.net for people who are trying to find that.
And really what this is a menu of recommendations. We don't pretend that all of these are going to be acted on in a given year, but these are programs and services that we know are effective. They work. And so the question is, how do we invest in these programs and move the ball forward?
Speaking of investments that you know work, and with the acknowledgement that not all of them are going to be acted on, or at least not right away, is there one that you think gives people the biggest bang for their buck, or gives the state the biggest bang for its buck, that you just think, look, this is the key thing that you should implement? If you do nothing else, this will really help.
We have got to address our housing crisis in Vermont. We have an affordable housing crisis in the state of Vermont. And right now, we know that the housing wage, which is how much you have to earn in order to be able to devote a third or less of your income to housing is now almost $20 an hour. So that's really two people working a minimum wage job just to be able to put a roof over their heads and have a third of their income go to meet their housing needs. VHFA has a housing profile that shows that 54% of Vermont's renters are spending more than 30% of their income.
VHFA, the Vermont Housing and Finance Agency.
Yes, more than 30% of their income on housing. So that just makes everything else incredibly difficult to meet your needs. And that's whether that's putting gas in the tank to get to work, food on the table for your kids, all the other basic necessities of life.
Listeners, is that resonating for you? Is housing the main issue that you see when we talk about, or one of the key issues when we talk about poverty, when we talk about how to make ends meet, how to make a life that works for you while you're working, while you're trying to raise kids, while you're trying to live in a state and have a quality of life? We'd love to know your thoughts on poverty and what we should be doing to address it. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. So, Chris Curtis, that housing problem, you mentioned that basically to get a decent apartment in Vermont, somebody would need to be making $20 an hour, or a couple would be needing to make two $10 an hour jobs just to afford that basic apartment.
A modest two-bedroom apartment is going to be over $1,000 a month at a market rate.
So is the problem housing and housing stock and how much that rental housing costs, or is the problem wages and low-wage jobs in Vermont?
I think it's a combination of factors, but what the state can do and what the council has proposed is to attack this aggressively. First, to aggressively deal with the issue of homelessness. We know that right now the state of Vermont spends almost $4 million a year to prevent homelessness through emergency anti-homelessness programs. Often that means putting somebody overnight in a motel, and we think there are better, more effective ways to do that. One of the ways that the administration has adopted as a result of recommendations from this council is something called the Vermont Rental Subsidy. So for folks who are on a waiting list to get a Section 8 federal subsidy but can't get it, the Vermont Rental Subsidy can fill that gap for up to 12 months of assistance. So for very low-income families who need some housing support, that's a great way to get into a private apartment, have a little bit of subsidy, and keep that family with a roof over their head. By the way, 80% of the Vermont Rental Subsidy participants are families on reach up. So that's our temporary cash assistance program. That's families with children who need housing, and they're able to access that. So that's a unique innovation that the state of Vermont has adopted as a result of this council's recommendations. And I give full credit to the administration and to the legislature, frankly, for building that into our budgets. I think what we should be doing is more of that kind of investment.
Well, and in fact, you advise increasing reach-up grants for Vermont families.
Absolutely, because we know that families living on a reach-up grant, which for a household of three is about $640 a month, you're not going to be able to meet your housing needs with that amount of money. So some kind of subsidy is required. And frankly, you know, what your listeners may not know is for very low-income people, about close to 70% of low-income Vermonters don't have any subsidy support. So for those families on the brink and keeping housing in their lives, that's essential. We've got to end homelessness, and there are better ways to do it than putting them temporarily in a motel room.
Well, and we may double back on homelessness because that's a big issue as we talk about this. And I want to get to a lot of other parts of the recommendations. But before we leave this question of housing, you know, you mentioned that this rental housing assistance can sort of bridge a gap for people who are on a waiting list for Section 8 housing, which is a federal program. I actually don't know where things stand right now, but we've talked on this program in the past about Section 8 housing at times where the wait list was so long and it was going to be so many years before people on that wait list could get into Section 8 housing that they closed the list. So it seems like 12 months may not even actually bridge the gap until somebody can get that federal assistance. So is 12 months going to do that, or will these families then be out in the cold after a year?
Well, I think the point is to create the conditions so that low-income Vermonters have an opportunity, an economic opportunity to try to get ahead. So 12 months of assistance may be enough time for somebody to get onto a wait list or get into housing. It may not, but at least it provides some stability. And it's a far wiser investment than just 28 nights in a motel room. And by the way, the council is not just saying to do this in a vacuum. The council's made a specific recommendation for a $2 per night occupancy fee for motels and hotels. Because if taxpayers are going to spend $4 million a year and give that money to motels to house people, this is a way for that industry to give something back and help to create sort of a closed feedback loop so that there's some revenue coming in. That would raise about $12 million a year to not only triage the existing program and maintain that, but build a bridge away from it to create demand reduction for the motel program, but stabilize people and help them move out. And that may be everything from more investments in affordable housing, in emergency housing, but also in things like weatherization, where people end up spending inordinate amounts of money on utilities and things like that, and then can't maintain their housing.
And just to be clear, that proposal is a revenue proposal that you've included in the recommendations. That $2 tax on all hotel stays would be hotel stays for tourists or Vermonters who are staying somewhere else. So anytime you go and pay for a hotel, there'd be a $2 fee added on that would go to this fund, basically, to help address poverty and homelessness and housing.
Yeah, and it's a wise revenue proposal because not only does it address a need for shelter, which is all part of that puzzle, but it's going to be largely falling on folks who can afford it because they're coming here to stay at our ski resorts or in our downtowns, coming from away to be here. So it's not going to disproportionately affect Vermonters.
Let's go to Carol, who's calling in from Proctor. Hi, Carol. Go right ahead. You're on the air.
Hi there. I think this is first of all, I just want to say thank you for the program because I think it's really important. I did want to express that I am a homeowner, but my mortgage and taxes and insurance are more than two-thirds of my monthly income. So I have an extremely hard time. Luckily, my kids are older now. And even debating whether I can't afford to have a house anymore. But the problem is everything is just too expensive. And there are a lot of folks that I know who are not eligible for other programs because our incomes are, you know, just over the poverty limit. But you might be just over the poverty limit, but you have $10 to spend on food for 3 weeks. And yet you can't get assistance anywhere else. So it's very frustrating. And I wish out of all the times that I've applied for assistance that they took into account how much my housing cost out of my total budget. But they're not interested in that. So
Carol,
the paper and I think about moving to an apartment. I know that a two-bedroom apartment I see costs $1,000.
Yeah, Carol, it sounds like you're in a tough spot. You're struggling to afford the house that you own, and then you think about selling it and look at what your rental possibilities are, and you'd be in another tight spot. Chris Curtis, I'm sure that's what you hear from a lot of Vermonters.
That's right. And I think the great thing about having a council and a report come out annually is that we can identify exactly those kinds of problems that Carol just mentioned, because I think what we can't do is further destabilize families like Carol's or those families who are just living below the poverty line. And so I think one of the tensions is that at a time of scarce resources in the state budget, there's a lot of hue and cry to reduce. And what that is doing is putting pressure on very low-income families. It's going to destabilize families. It's actually going to set us back. So I think the benchmark is, are we moving the ball forward? Are we helping people escape from poverty? Or are we setting families farther back? And my view is that when you take away from these safety net programs, you're actually setting people back. You're not investing in people and providing opportunity. We're moving backwards. And we can't afford to do that.
Let's go to Joe Henry calling in from Isle LaMotte. Hi, Joe Henry, your thoughts.
Hi. My thoughts is the price of food in Vermont and not having access to more cheaper food. Here in Isle of Man, I'm obviously an hour from Montreal or an hour to Burlington. I get the bulk of my food on the side of the road, you know, buying bags of potatoes for $10. But what I've gone to farmers markets, and I kind of think that they're kind of going like towards the whole food. And I think that these farmers are paying way too much to just be in a farmers market where it should actually be free. I think the whole emphasis has to be is how do you make food so much more cheaper when you can actually buy it that much more cheaper.
Joe Henry, good point. Food, the cost of food, another issue that's certainly one of the factors in people who are living in poverty. We talked a lot about that yesterday on the show, how we can address hunger in this state. Let's go to Holly. This is Holly Morehouse, Executive Director of Vermont After School, Inc. Holly, go right ahead. Your thoughts.
Thank you. I wanted to thank the council for this report and the recommendations and draw attention to the education section and where the report recommends providing all students with extended day or after-school programs. This is extremely important. As we know, after-school programs are a critical resource for working families, essential in addressing the opportunity gap between rich and poor, and providing fundamental support such as healthy snacks and meals, connecting to that comment about food, in the after-school and evening hours. And we know that investing in after-school and summer learning programs in the long run will help children and families move out of poverty and also save money for the state. My question to the co-chair is the council including summer learning programs under this recommendation for investment, given that we know that research has shown that up to two-thirds of the academic achievement gap between low-income children and their middle and upper-income peers can be attributed to differences in summer learning opportunities.
Holly, thanks for your question. Chris Curtis?
Yeah, Holly, great point, and I think you're absolutely correct. I mean, schools are really a melting pot in a way for, despite wherever you come from on the socioeconomic spectrum, schools are extremely important and need to be maintained, and that's everything from the pre-K efforts that have been made to expand pre-K opportunities for all Vermonters to extended opportunities. One of the things that's in the report is universal school meals, making sure that all kids have enough to eat while they're at school and doing that year-round. So extremely important, and we want to make sure that that is an opportunity that's available to all Vermont kids.
More to come today as we talk about poverty and the recommendations just made by the Council on Pathways from Poverty. It's a council that was mandated to come up with some recommendations for how Vermont could address poverty and help get people back on stable footing. If you'd like to share your questions or your thoughts, or maybe you've read the report, maybe you work in this kind of sector and you want to share what you think would work, our number is 1-800-639-2211, or you can post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're looking at a series of recommendations the Council on Pathways from Poverty has just made to the governor. The council was created by statute to address the needs of vulnerable Vermonters. We're hearing what the suggestions in the new report would cost and why co-chair Christopher Curtis thinks they would help alleviate poverty. If you'd like to share your thoughts on what you think should be done or what might help you, call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. On the line with us now is Elizabeth Reedy. She's director of the John Graham Emergency Shelter in Vergennes, and she's also a member of the council. Liz Reedy, thanks for talking with us.
Hey, Jane. How you doing?
Great. So I'd love to know from you, we talked a little bit about housing, and Chris Curtis mentioned the importance of addressing homelessness. What do you think is key to address homelessness and to make sure that fewer Vermonters are facing this reality?
Well, first off, I think people need to understand that the families who are homeless are working, first and foremost, just like Chris said. We have five houses in Addison County, Jane. We have 15 families in those five houses right now, along with single individuals. But let's just talk families with children. 15 families with children. Of those, 12 are working, 2 are disabled, and 1 is looking. So, you know, the vast, and some of those, we have 2 parents working. So just imagine being homeless and being working. I'm thinking about a woman that got offered a position yesterday. She had, it was the night shift. You know, it's the 11 to 7. She has little children. It's such a tough life to put in a shift like that, come back, get the kids up, get them ready to school. They go to school. You catch a few Z's in between, and then you're there to meet them when they come home, and then back. Off to the night shift again. So it's a tough job, and they're not making enough to afford to get into their own place. And that's where it's really difficult. So the recommendations of the council for housing come really in three areas. First of all, we have the what Chris talked about, the Vermont rental subsidy, the support, family housing, and also the housing opportunity program through the Office of Economic Opportunity. We have those recommendations to strengthen those particular supports. The second piece is services for people. People need help repairing their credit. We have a suite of recommendations about that. Then the third, there's really four legs to the stool. The third is money for the Vermont Housing and Conservation Board. Each of our five units, Jane, has been, we've been able to purchase them and rehab them through the Vermont Housing and Conservation Board, and they are responsible for thousands of affordable units around the state. So we're really recommending making sure that that housing stock is there so that we can battle against this 1% vacancy rate. The fourth piece doesn't cost money, and that is that for those units that are publicly funded, at least 15% of them really do need to go to these working families that are in shelters now. So as the units are funded, as they come online, let's make sure that the families that are really, really struggling are getting those units. So I think that our recommendations really do cover all four of those. And the only other thing I would really put a plug for in the report is the one that talks about a culture of kindness within the Agency of Human Services, within all of our agencies. You do see people struggling with substances. You do see people under supervision of the Department of Children and Families. But if we can just, when we talk with people, when we work with people, if we can just mirror a respect and a sense that, yes, you can do it, we're there to support you, I think that that culture of kindness and that culture of care, along with being firm, I think it really makes a lot of difference for people. I know it does. And John Graham, so I think it would at the agency as well.
That's Elizabeth Reedy. She is director of the John Graham Emergency Shelter and a member of this Council on Pathways from Poverty. Elizabeth Reedy, thank you very much for sharing your thoughts with us.
Hey, Jane, can I just add one thing?
No, but I will tell people you have a sleep out coming in December, and we have a link to it at vpr.net. Click on Vermont Edition. You can find it there. I want to make sure we have as much time as possible for more in this report. But Elizabeth, I do know you wanted to mention that. So thanks again for being on the program. You know, Chris Curtis, Liz Reedy mentioned this idea of a culture of kindness at the Agency of Human Services. And this is one of the things that is contained in your report as a recommendation, but one that doesn't cost any money. And you have a few other things like that that you also include that you say just implement these and they'll help and they're not going to be something that costs taxpayers. So, for example, an initiative that you'd like to see expanded to every employer that right now is for public sector workers, where employers cannot ask in an initial written application form, that initial entry for somebody who's trying to apply for a job, then employers should not be able to ask whether or not that person has been arrested. Why not?
This is actually a really, it's a no-brainer. It's a common sense solution. And many large retailers like Walmart and Target are already doing this. But we have, for Vermonters who are re-entering their communities and need work because they've been through corrections and now they're coming home, we need employment opportunities for them. And for many people, when they see that box on the application and they have to check the box that says you were previously convicted of a crime, even if it was a long time ago, for a lot of people, that separates the wheat from the chaff, and they're just not even going to get an opportunity to explain their circumstances or why they might be qualified to do the job. And of course, in Vermont, we have a very low unemployment rate, and we have employers actually clamoring to get more qualified workers. So this is a no-brainer. This is a way that we can say, let's give people a fair shake and a second chance, get them employed, reduce recidivism, and create more economic opportunities for more Vermonters. It only makes sense. It doesn't deny, as you correctly point out, it doesn't deny employers the opportunity at the interview level or in a secondary application or something to get more about somebody's background.
Including whether or not they've been convicted of a crime.
Absolutely. But if you get your foot in the door, you can actually explain that you're qualified for the position and that whatever happened is in your past. You've been rehabilitated, and now you're ready to contribute. And I think a lot of employers would see that as an opportunity to bring people in and provide them with a chance.
Chris, another thing that you have in the report is that you would like to see a program expanded statewide that was fairly successful in Chittenden County earlier this year to help drivers with suspended licenses get those licenses back. This would not cost any money, although there is a case to be made for, you know, if you're forgiving many of the fees that people or the charges that people have, that you're leaving money on the table. But you say, actually, probably not.
You know, transportation is a huge barrier for low-income Vermonters. And what we learned through a terrific initiative by State's Attorney T.J. Donovan and the Shumlin administration called Driver Restoration Day was that there is an overwhelming need for Vermonters to get back on the road safely, legally, and affordably. You know, we have 34,000 driver's licenses suspended in the state of Vermont, and 22,000 of those are simply for inability to pay the fines. And so the consequence is that many people just find themselves in a hole, and they end up having to make tough choices about driving their kids to school or driving to work to put food on the table when they probably shouldn't be because the license has been suspended. And then they end up getting hit over and over and over again. So this is a symptom of income inequality, frankly, because somebody who's well off or a high income person just pays the fine once and move on with their lives. But if you're very poor, a $300 or $400 or $500 fine might as well be a couple thousand dollars. They're just not going to be able to pay it. And so this is a way to say, if you're on public assistance or if you meet a certain income threshold, let's get you that rock bottom fine price. Pay it. You got to have some reciprocity and take some responsibility, but you got to pay something and then get back on the road in a way that ensures the safety of all drivers on the road, frankly.
So people who are receiving some assistance would pay less for a speeding fine, for example, than somebody who's not?
Well, there's a task force right now that's looking at this and trying to figure out what's the right metric or the best way to approach this. But I can tell you, for example, in my practice, I'm an attorney of Vermont Legal Aid. And for folks who are on public assistance, if you get a judgment against you in small claims court, for example, you're considered judgment proof. You're uncollectible. I'm not suggesting we do that for traffic fines, but I think that there's a certain threshold. If you're on public assistance and the taxpayers are essentially paying for your expenses anyway, let's make these fines something that's affordable, that people can pay, move on with their lives, and keep that job.
We got a note from Steve who wants to know about how alcohol, drug, and tobacco use contribute to poverty. But Steve says, why do we coddle addicts instead of demanding that they clean up their act? The war on poverty allows people to keep these addictions rather than demanding that they get a job. So in the time we have left, Chris, I'd like for you to address that perspective.
I think it's a great question. There's a ton that we need to do around addiction and abuse. But I would say that I think I would flip Steve's point around, which is that I think poverty and depression and anxiety actually can lead to the addiction. Because for many people, when you're faced with impossible challenges in your life, self-medication is a way to get through every day. And so I think we actually need to look at the root causes of addiction, not just treating it as a health matter, which we should be, but we've got to deal with poverty first.
That's Christopher Curtis. He's an attorney for Vermont Legal Aid and co-chair of the Council on Pathways from Poverty. When we see what happens in the legislative session, we'll be following some of the recommendations that have been made by the council to see what gets taken up by the legislature and what may or may not pass. Chris Curtis, thanks for talking with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. A few years ago in Vermont, there was a brief but robust public conversation about sexting, the practice of texting or emailing sexually explicit photos of oneself. The concern was about teenagers who were doing this, and Vermont lawmakers tried to provide a legislative solution to clarify the blurry line between consent and exploitation. Well, if one Vermont school's experience is any measure, sexting not only continues, it's commonplace. And while adults may consider teen sexting to be deeply problematic, teens themselves think differently. Last week, the principal of Champlain Valley Union High School in Hinesburg emailed the entire school community with a message that was meant to begin a series of conversations among students, parents, and teachers. CVU Principal Adam Bunting posited a lot of unanswered questions in that message about the social norms for teens and technology and relationships. Yesterday afternoon, he invited students to meet with him in the school library to begin a dialogue about sexting, and we talked with him afterwards.
I was hoping there'd be a huge student turnout, but it turns out, you know, not every high school student wants to talk about sex with their high school principal. So,
I'm glad I've got the tape running for that line.
Yeah.
So there wasn't much of a turnout?
There wasn't a huge turnout, and partly the fault is mine in not publicizing it all that well. But I will tell you that the students who were there provided me with some really good thinking, and I will tell you that I'm sure I ended up doing more learning than they did.
We were talking about it just in our newsroom, like, you know, this is so different than dating when we were growing up in the pre-smartphone era. And even though we think we're hip, and it still seems so foreign to us.
Yeah, that's what, you know, it's interesting when people have been talking about sexting with me, I keep trying to remind them that this is actually less about sexting and more about gender roles and more about generational gaps and also about kind of the influence of technology on one's lives. And the number of times that I've heard adults say, in the course of the last few weeks, I'm so glad I didn't have that technology when I was that age.
Yeah.
You know, it's been more than I can count.
Yeah, or that I was a principal when there was that technology. Well, was it uncomfortable for you to have to send out an email to your entire school community about sexting, and not just a note about sexting, but one that asked a lot more questions than it answered?
To be honest, it actually felt liberating and felt important, because anytime you're involved in an investigation as an administrator in a school, you're really influencing your school culture in some ways that you might not like, particularly when it's around student cell phones. I met with a group of students today who were talking to me about what their cell phone represents for them, and they describe their phone as, and I'm quoting this, "Your phone is that place that is uniquely yours." And another student described their phone as an extension of themselves. And we got in this great discussion about, you know, how people end up creating selves for their friends, selves for their girlfriends or boyfriends, selves for their parents, the self they present to their friends' parents, the self they present to their teachers. And we began to talk about, well, which self is really the one that's truest to you? Is it the one on your phone, or is it the one that you're presenting in public? And you start to think about these phones as extensions of not only the social life, but kind of the inner life of a student. And all of a sudden, an administrator is searching that phone, and someone's looking through that phone. It creates a culture that you don't want in a school.
When you say searching and administrator searching, was this email that you had sent out to everybody precipitated by a specific event where an administrator did have to search someone's phone?
Yeah, I would say that it's precipitated by, I think, a fairly common event in schools, and that is what happens when, you know, a couple is in a relationship and then that relationship ends and someone shares photos that they shouldn't have, or even someone solicits a photo from someone and that photo is shared with a group. That fear that students have when they walk into a school building and say, oh my God, has that person seen that picture of me? Has that person seen that picture of me? And, you know, as an administrator, you begin to see how disruptive that is to the learning process, that fear. So anytime we have a report where, you know, that really falls under a sexual harassment policy, you know, we have to investigate those. And anyone who's done an investigation before in a school knows that once you begin, you know, there are so many other names that come out. There's other information that comes out you have to follow up on. So what starts out as small can often blossom into something larger than you might expect.
And is that the case at CVU? Do you think that this is a bigger issue than people might expect?
I don't think the issue is any different at CVU than any other school in the country right now.
And to the extent that it's the same as every other school in the country, is it a big issue?
I'm not trying to dodge the question, I promise. In talking with the students today, I asked them to estimate how many of their peers they thought had shared nude photos of themselves. And, you know, students gave me a number of like, yeah, I think, you know, it's hard to say, maybe 40%. And so I said, wait, you mean 40% of, you know, 1,200 students, the 1,200 students are here? And they said, yeah, I think that number would be about right. So, you know, what we're dealing with, I think, is a generation where normal, the normal expectations around dating is very different than the normal expectations around dating for what my generation were.
Well, so is this just modern love and dating for young people that includes pictures that perhaps to other generations or perhaps in bad situations seem inappropriate?
I'm trying to learn that. I am trying to figure that out. And I will tell you that I came into, you know, I've come into these conversations with an open mind and more curiosity than anything. I had a student today say to me, he said, "Well, adults send nudes too, don't they?" I mean, didn't Brett Favre just get in trouble for something like this? So I couldn't help but chuckle at that.
But that's part of the question, isn't it? I mean, we think back to New York Congressman Anthony Weiner. He sent some photos of himself, and it lost him his job. So
right.
There are certainly consequences to this that perhaps people aren't necessarily thinking about, especially when they're young and in lust or love.
Yeah. I asked the students today, well, what's normal and when is sending a nude picture a problem? And a student articulated it well, saying, it's a problem when the author loses control of the audience.
Hmm.
You know, when the person that you've intended to send that photo to shares that's what students are seeing as the issue. That may not be the issue for us. I mean, I think as you get older, obviously you have a better understanding of the permanence of some of these things and, you know, that what it maybe feels like to live with some of those regrets.
Well, so if students are saying to you the problem is really when you as the sender lose control of the photo that you've sent and it gets sent around to other people, if that's the real issue, how do you try to combat that or try to deal with that within your student population?
That is the $64,000 question. You know, I think it begins with open dialogue, and I really mean dialogue. I don't mean one of those fake dialogues that we have where we're just intending to tell students our point of view. I'll also tell you that one of the most important pieces that we need to talk about is how the law treats some of this. And, you know, it's pretty quickly apparent that students can be looking at felonies for something to them that is normal.
Right, because this can be considered a sex crime.
Yeah, I mean, in my conversations that I've had with the Department of Children and Families, you know, they are much less interested in if you're in a relationship and you're sharing those photos, fine. The second someone starts sharing those photos outside of the relationship, then basically you've committed a sex crime and there's going to be an investigation.
Well, Adam, why can't you say, look, I'm now washing my hands of it. This is not a school issue. Here's the rule. Leave your phones in your lockers. Sext when you get home. Don't bring it to campus. And it's not a school issue.
Right. Well, it becomes a school issue anytime someone comes into school and feels like their learning process is disrupted. So we as school administrators don't have a choice. And, you know, one of the pieces that I talked about in the letter was with some of the changes in the harassment law over the past 5 years, things have become very polarized to the extent that I think people's thinking really shuts down when you start having to describe students as victims, as perpetrators, as aggressors. You've got 24 hours to launch an investigation and notify parties. You've got 5 days to conclude that. You have to use the language. You have to write letters to everybody. You know, much of the sexting falls under the sexual harassment policies of probably every school in the state.
Hmm. So it is something that all schools are going to have to deal with.
Absolutely. So, you know, I think a lot of times we try to deal with things quietly because we don't want people judging our communities or our schools. But I can tell you, this is happening everywhere.
That was Adam Bunting, principal of Champlain Valley Union High School in Hinesburg. He says the next steps at his school will include assemblies to cover the legal jeopardy that students put themselves in when they share sexual images of themselves or others. He says he wants to continue the conversation about new social norms for teens and technology and relationships. And Principal Bunting also left us with this thought to ponder.
The students were talking about how when that phone is at that place that's uniquely yours, it's the place that you can be independent most easily without people seeing you. And I sort of have this feeling that on a societal level, that if we were more respectful of our teenagers and didn't infantilize them as much as we do, that maybe if we gave them a little more control, they wouldn't have to seek that control in ways that are so secret.
We are curious about how you are handling these questions with teenagers in your life. Tell us about it on our Facebook page or email vermontedition@vpr.net. The death of Lara Sobel, a social worker for the Department for Children and Families, who was fatally shot outside a state office building in Barrie in August, was deeply unsettling. And it raised serious concerns about safety for Vermont social workers. Yesterday, the Vermont State Employees Association presented three safety recommendations to a legislative committee. Tracy Casanova is a social worker and a VSEA member, and she joins us now. Tracy, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you.
There are three basic recommendations you made, and they're very targeted and specific. The first is to impose a caseload cap for caseworkers of 12 open ongoing cases at a time. For investigators, no more than 100 investigations per year, and supervisors shouldn't have to supervise more than 6 social workers at a time. Secondly, ensure that there's trained, armed law enforcement or security staff at all of the offices where family service staffers are working. And finally, to get the state police at full staffing capacity so that troopers can go out with social workers when there's a situation that warrants it. Why are those three steps necessary?
So what we know at this point in time is that there is a correlation between staff safety and caseloads. And at this point in time, social workers' caseloads are so high, and they're with everything that's required of them to do for all the cases, they're not adequately able to assess situations for their safety as they would like to be able to do. So that's why that that recommendation regarding caseload caps is so important. And in terms of building security, we deal with a population that at times can be very volatile, and with people who have histories of violence, mental health issues, and substance abuse issues, and they're coming into our building. And so it would be important for us, for social workers, to feel safe in the work that they're doing. And so having law enforcement security in all 12 district offices, we believe, is really important.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, the questions that you raise, or the recommendations that you have about armed security personnel at the offices and state police who can go with you, make sense in terms of a safety perspective. I think it's the one about having caseloads capped as a safety measure that may be surprising to people. And you say it's because you need the space to form those relationships.
Absolutely. So social workers have great abilities in terms of engaging families and forming relationships with them in order to assess child safety and their own safety. And it's really difficult to do when the caseloads are so high. And it makes it almost impossible to be able to form those relationships and to do the proper background checks on people before going out and meeting with them.
You've been a social worker since 2003. Have you felt like your own personal safety has been in jeopardy? Can you tell me about a situation?
There have been times that I have been threatened to be killed, for my building to be blown up. People have sent information to my personal home where I live with my family. So there have been numerous times that I have been concerned for my own personal safety.
Well, Tracy, what keeps you doing this work when there are those kinds of threats leveled at you because of your job?
I love my job, and I am passionate about child protection and believe in it. I feel privileged to be able to talk with children and families on a daily basis about sometimes terrible things that have happened to them and things that they're struggling through, and it's amazing to me about how resilient children and families are despite all of the obstacles that they have. And I love the opportunity to be able to help people, and so that they can stay together as a family and they can heal from things that have happened to them.
So you think these moves, these recommendations that the VSEA made yesterday, will help keep you safe and allow you to do your job without worrying about safety?
I think that it will help lessen the worry. So with these added measures, I think that the worry can go down.
You know, these will cost money, and certainly that question of caseloads and trying to hire more caseworkers so that caseloads could be lowered, that costs money. The idea of fully staffing the state police, that's another budget line item. Do you think that there's a likelihood that this will actually happen in the next legislative session?
I really hope that it happens and it's considered, and I don't think you can put a dollar amount on the cost of a social worker's lives or a child's lives. Without some of these changes, we're not adequately able to do our jobs. And so I don't think you can put a dollar amount on that. And I recognize that it is something that will cost money. And I think it's an investment that it's worthwhile.
What would it say to you if the state does not follow these recommendations?
I would be disappointed. I would be really disappointed.
Do you think that it would speak to your value as a state worker?
Yes, I do.
Well, Tracy Casanova, social worker and a member of the Vermont State Employees Association, thank you very much for talking with us and sharing your perspective as a social worker on what you think would help increase your safety.
Thank you for having me.
The VSEA just presented 3 safety recommendations for how to protect social workers like Tracy Casanova. We'll have more information at vpr.net. And that does it for today's show. Open enrollment for Vermont Health Connect began about 3 weeks ago, and state officials were optimistic that this time around, the problems that have plagued the enrollment process would be fixed. Tomorrow on Vermont Edition, we'll get an update on how the state healthcare exchange is working. And we want to hear from you. Tell us how your experiences with Vermont Health Connect have changed or not over the last couple of years. Email vermontedition@vpr.net and listen tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Singeri and Sam Gale Rosen. We have production assistance from Aaron Lucy. Liam Connors directed the program, and our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.